Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 63. It's July 27th, 2020. I'll break from regular form just a bit to mention that this essay was released in October of 2008. Oy, what a mess. The mess of which I speak is, of course, U.S. political economy. And make no mistake about it, we are talking about political economy. One of the things I have long admired about Austrian school theorists, such as Ludwig von Mises, F.A. Hayek, and Murray Rothbard, is their understanding of political economy, a concept that conveys, by its very coupling, the inextricable tie between the political and the economic. When Austrian school theorists have examined the dynamics of market exchange, they have stressed the importance not only of the larger political context within which such exchanges take place, but also the ways in which politics influences and molds the shape and character of those exchanges. Indeed, with regard to financial institutions in particular, they have placed the state at the center of their economic theories on money and credit. Throughout the modern history of the system that most people call capitalism, banking institutions have had such a profoundly intimate relationship to the state that one can only refer to it as a state banking nexus. As I point out in my book, Total Freedom Toward a Dialectical Libertarianism, a nexus is, by definition, a dialectical unity of mutual implication. Aristotle stresses that the nexus must be reciprocal. The necessary occurrence of this involves the necessary occurrence of something prior. And conversely, given the prior, it is also necessary for the posterior to come to be. For Aristotle, this constitutes a symbiotic circular movement. As such, the benefits that are absorbed by the state banking nexus are mutually reinforcing. Each institution becomes both a precondition and effect of the other. The current state and the current banking sector require one another. Neither can exist without the other. They are so reciprocally intertwined that each is an extension of the other. Remember this point the next time somebody tells you that, quote, free market madmen, end quote, caused the current financial crisis that is threatening to undermine the economy. There is no free market. There is no laissez-faire capitalism. The government has been deeply involved in setting the parameters for market relations for eons. In fact, genuine laissez-faire capitalism has never existed. Yes, trade may have been less regulated in the 19th century, but not even the so-called Gilded Age featured unfettered markets. One of the reasons I've come to dislike using the term capitalism is that it has never historically manifested fully its so-called unknown ideals. Real, actual, historically specific capitalism has always entailed the intervention of the state. And that intervention has always had a class character. That is, the actions of the state have always and must always benefit some groups differentially at the expense of others. Mises understood this when he constructed his theory of money and credit. For Mises, there is no such thing as neutral government action, just as surely as there is no such thing as neutral money. As he pointed out in his theory of money and credit, changes in the quantity of money and in the demand for money never occur for all individuals at the same time and to the same degree, and they therefore never affect their judgments of value to the same extent and at the same time. Mises traced how, with the erosion of a gold standard, an inflation of the money supply would diffuse slowly throughout the economy, benefiting those, such as banks, and certain capital-intensive industries, who were among its early recipients. One of the reasons a gold standard was abandoned is that a gold standard is incompatible with a structural policy of inflation and with a system heavily dependent on government interventionism. The profiteers of systematic inflation are not difficult to pinpoint. Taking their lead from Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard and such New Left revisionist historians as Gabriel Kolko and James Weinstein, Walter Grinder and John Hagel III point out in their classic article, Toward a Theory of State Capitalism, Ultimate Decision-Making, and Class Structure, historically, state intervention in the banking system has been one of the earliest forms of intervention in the market system. In the U.S., this intervention initially involved sporadic measures both at the federal and state level, which generated inflationary distortion in the monetary supply and cyclical disruptions of economic activity. The disruptions which accompanied the business cycle were a major factor in the transformation of the dominant ideology in the United States from a general adherence to laissez-faire doctrines to an ideology of political capitalism, which viewed the state as a necessary instrument for the rationalization and stabilization of an inherently unstable economic order. This transformation in ideology paved the way for the full-scale cartelization of the banking sector through the Federal Reserve System. The pressure for systematic state intervention in the banking sector originated both among the banks themselves and from certain industries which, because of capital-intensive production processes and long lead times, sought the stability necessary for the long-term planning of their investment strategies. The historical evidence confirms that the Federal Reserve legislation and other forms of state intervention in the banking sector during the first decades of the 20th century received active support from influential banking and industrial interests. More importantly, however, cartelization of banking activity permits banks to inflate their asset base systematically. The creation of assets made possible by these measures to a great extent frees the banking institutions from the constraints imposed by the passive form of ultimate decision-making exercised by their depositors. It thereby considerably strengthens the ultimate decision-making authority held by banks vis-a-vis their depositors. The inflationary trends resulting from the creation of assets tend to increase the ratio of external financing to internal financing in large corporations, and as a consequence, the ultimate decision-making power of banking institutions increases over the activities of industrial corporations. Since the capital market naturally emerges as a strategic locus of ultimate decision-making in market economies, it is reasonable to assume that by virtue of their intimate ties with the state apparatus, banking institutions will acquire an additional function within the state capitalist system, serving as an intermediary between the leading economic interests and the state. So, one of the major consequences of inflation, especially in a monetary system stripped of a gold standard, is a shift of wealth and income toward banks and their beneficiaries. But this financial interventionism also sets off a process that Hayek would have dubbed a road to serfdom. For inflation introduces a host of distortions into the delicate structure of investment and production, setting off boom and bust and a process of retrogression from a relatively free market to a system characterized by an increasingly fascistic set of economic relationships, as Grinder and Hagel put it. Just as the institution of central banking generates a process of retrogression at home, engendering additional domestic interventions that try to correct for the very distortions, conflicts, and contradictions it creates, so too does it make possible a structure of foreign interventions. In fact, it can be said that the very institution of central banking was born, as Rothbard argues in The Mystery of Banking, as a, quote, crooked deal between a near-bankrupt government and a corrupt clique of financial promoters in an effort to sustain British colonialism. The reality is not much different today, but it is a bit more complex in terms of the insidious means by which government funds wars and thereby undermines a productive economy. Of course, the funding itself benefits certain interests too, but we'll leave our sermon on the military-industrial complex for another day. So where does this leave us today? Much has already been said about the most recent financial crisis viewed from a radical libertarian and Austrian perspective, which helps to clarify its interventionist roots. The seeds for this particular crisis were planted some years ago, but the interventionist policies now being proposed and implemented have been around even longer. They are tried and true methods of further concentrating the power of ultimate decision-making in the state banking nexus. Indeed, as Robert Higgs notes, even the federal authority to take over AIG is rooted in a Depression-era law. See also this post by David Thoreau and links therein, as well as commentary by Ron Paul and Sheldon Richman. on the current crisis, Stephen Horwitz has written a superb open letter to those on the left, from which I'd like to quote at length. It explains the origin of the housing bubble in the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and places that crisis in a wider economic context, political economic context, shaped by governmental and Federal Reserve policies. By all means, read Horwitz's whole essay and follow the links therein as well, which are missing in the passage cited here. Now quoting from Horwitz. For starters, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-sponsored enterprises. Though technically privately owned, they have particular privileges granted by the government, they are overseen by Congress, and most importantly, they have operated with a clear promise that if they failed, they would be bailed out. In 1995, Fannie and Freddie were given permission to enter the subprime market, and regulators began to crack down on banks who were not lending enough to distressed areas. In addition, Congress explicitly directed Fannie and Freddie to expand their lending to borrowers with marginal credit as a way of expanding home ownership. What all of these policies did together was to create an enormous profit and political incentive for banks and Fannie and Freddie to lend more to riskier low-income borrowers. However, well-intentioned, the attempts were to extend home ownership to more Americans, forcing banks to do so and artificially lowering the cost of doing so, are a huge part of the problem we now find ourselves in. At the same time, home prices were rising, making those who had taken on large mortgages with small down payments feel as though they could handle them, and it's buying a whole variety of new mortgage instruments. What's interesting is that the rise in prices affected most strongly cities with stricter land use regulations, which also explains the fact that not every city was affected to the same degree by the rising home values. While all of this was happening, the Federal Reserve, nominally private but granted enormous monopoly privileges by government, was pumping in the capital and driving interest rates lower and lower. Ah, one way to keep those funds flowing for the Iraq War. That's a comment inserted by our essay's author, not Horwitz. This influx of credit further fueled the borrowing binge. With plenty of funds available, thanks to your friendly monopoly central bank, hardly the free market at work, banks could afford to continue to lend riskier and riskier. The final chapter of the story is that in 2004 and 2005, following the accounting scandals at Freddie, both Freddie and Fannie paid penance to Congress by agreeing to expand their lending to low-income customers. Both agreed to acquire greater amounts of subprime and Alt-A loans, sending the green light to banks to originate them. From 2004 to 2006, the percentage of loans in those riskier categories grew from 8% to 20% of all U.S. mortgage originations. The banks were taking on riskier borrowers, but knew they had a guaranteed buyer for those loans in Fannie and Freddie, backed, of course, by us taxpayers. Yes, banks were greedy for new customers and riskier loans, but they were responding to incentives created by well-intentioned but misguided government interventions. It is these interventions that are ultimately responsible for the risky loans gone bad that are at the center of the current crisis, not the free market. The current mess is clearly shot through and through with government meddling with free markets. From the Fed-provided fuel to the CRA and land use regulations to Fannie and Freddie creating an artificial market for risky mortgages in order to meet Congress's demands for more home ownership opportunities for low-income families. Thanks to that intervention, many of those families have lost not only their homes, but also the savings they could have held on to for a few more years and perhaps used to acquire a less risky mortgage on a cheaper house. All of these interventions into the market created the incentive and the means for banks to profit by originating loans that never would have taken place in a genuinely free market. It is worth noting that these regulations, policies, and interventions were often gladly supported by the private interests involved. Fannie and Freddie made billions while home prices rose, and their CEOs got paid lavishly. The same was true of the various banks and other mortgage market intermediaries who helped spread and price the risk that was in play, including those who developed all kinds of fancy new financial instruments, all designed to deal with the heightened risk of default the intervention brought with it. This was a wonderful game they were playing, and the financial markets were happy to have Fannie and Freddie as voracious buyers of risky loans, knowing that U.S. taxpayer dollars were always there if needed. The history of business regulation in the U.S. is the history of firms using regulation for their own purposes, regardless of the public interest patina over the top of them. This is precisely what happened in the housing market, and it's also why calls for more regulation and more intervention are so misguided. They have failed before and will fail again, because those with the profits on the line are the ones who have the resources and access to power to ensure that the game is rigged in their favor. That's the end of Horowitz's part, and we're back to Siabara. This is precisely correct. Indeed, there are those of a certain political bent who might seek to place blame for the current financial crisis on the recipients of subprime mortgages, particularly those in minority communities. But if elements of the current housing bubble can be traced to Clinton administration attempts to appeal to traditional Democratic voting blocs, it's not as if the banks were dragged kicking and screaming into lending those mortgages. This is, in a nutshell, the whole problem, the whole history of government intervention, as Horowitz argues. Even if a case can be made that the road to this particular housing bubble hell was paved with the good intentions of those who wanted to nourish a, quote, ownership society, end quote, their actions necessarily generated deleterious unintended consequences. When governments have the power to set off such a feeding frenzy, government power becomes the only power worth having, as Hayek observed so long ago. If our presidential candidates wish to end the influence of Washington lobbyists, they should consider ending the power of Washington to dispense privilege, because that privilege will always be dispensed in ways that benefit ultimate decision makers. It is not simply that intervention breeds corruption. It's that corruption is inherent in the process itself. It is therefore no surprise that the loudest advocates for the effective nationalization of finance are to be found on Wall Street. At this point, failing financiers welcome any government actions that will socialize their risks. But such actions that socialize losses while keeping the profits in private hands are a hallmark of fascist and neo-fascist economies. They are just another manifestation of Horowitz's first law of political economy. No one hates capitalism more than capitalists. In the end, the proposed Paulson plan is nothing more than a heist. As Robert P. Murphy argues, a grand scheme in which the public will end up owing hundreds of billions of dollars to holders of new debt claims issued by the U.S. Treasury. Such a plan will only compound the problem. As Frank Shostak explains, government policies that try to prevent a fall in the stock market cannot prevent a fall in the real economy. In fact, the real economy has already been damaged by the previous loose monetary stance. All that the fall in the stock market does is inform us about the true state of economic conditions. The fall in the price of stocks just puts things in a proper perspective. The fall in the price in the stock price is just an acknowledgement of reality. By not allowing market participants to work through the distortions therein created, government might very well plunge the economy into the mother of all recessions. Of course, there's a lot more that needs to be done to correct this economy structurally. But have no fear. Such structural change will not come to this economy without fundamental, intellectual, and cultural change. That, my friends, is not on the menu. The chefs who prepare the current menu of choices belong to a loosely defined political economic class centered around the state banking nexus I mentioned earlier. The choices they offer might modify the regulations here or there, free up some institutions, while regulating others more heavily. They can only hope that their limited choices will guide them out of the current crisis while still enabling them to retain their hold on ultimate decision-making. And they have been in the past remarkably effective at steering course between extremes, which is why the system has never toppled. With regard to the stability of the current system, I strongly recommend a book by Sanford Akita on the dynamics of the mixed economy toward a theory of interventionism. Though it might make you feel that we're doomed and that nothing will ever change fundamentally. If all of this sounds diabolically conspiratorial, well, It is, in a sense, even if the ultimate decision makers are not getting together in a single room trying to hatch the next great conspiracy. In fact, the reality is uglier. The culture of conspiracy is such that these plans are being hatched ad hoc by those within that state banking nexus, presented to the public as the next great rescue plan for the common good. Yet nobody inside or outside that nexus has the knowledge to coordinate any centrally guided plan to correct the economy. But try to correct it, they will. Lord help us. That's why I maintain it does not matter one iota who gets elected president. The emphases might vary slightly under Obama or McCain, but the fundamentals of U.S. political economy, and I should add, U.S. foreign policy, will not change. Indeed, even for those of us who view the current Bush administration as the worst in our history, well, certainly the worst in our lifetime, it is clear that nothing proposed by Obama or McCain is going to change the structural defects of this system. It is the government's monetary, fiscal, and global policies that have created insurmountable debt and record budget deficits, speculative booms, and bubble bursts. In such a crisis of global statism, nationalizations and bailouts are not the only goodies in this rescue package being wrapped up as an unwanted gift for taxpayers. And because there is an organic link between domestic and foreign policy, be prepared for even more tragic fiscal and monetary irresponsibility at home and ever-expanding institutionalized war abroad. Indeed, the ultimate decision makers of U.S. political economy have a host of new battlefields on which to wage war, both literally and figuratively, in their efforts to stabilize the ship of state. None of the choices being offered will challenge their hegemony or topple them from their positions of power. But a war beckons. It is primarily an intellectual and cultural one, and it must begin by questioning the fundamental basis of the current system in any effort to overturn it. And again, this was in October of 2008. The man's name is Chris Matthew Ciabarra. And I read it way back then. It stayed on my mind. And this crisis of political economy. It's interesting how long these things take out to play out. It's like bullet time in the Matrix. Just everything can slow down. It's fascinating because so much time has passed since October of 2008. We've had two entire Obama administrations. Here we are 3 years into this current one and all the surreality that entails. And it seems quite true that it, as far as the structural underpinnings were concerned, it didn't matter who won, McCain or Obama. This Dodd-Frank, as discussed previously, has only strengthened the too big to fail. They're now bigger, and the regional banks are in an even more precarious and tough position. It's very hard to be George Bailey, near impossible. You have to be Mr. Potter. Pottersville is ascendant. Bailey Park is having trouble. Irrespective of COVID and all this tough situation and predicament on top of everything. And amazingly, our solution to get through this also seems to just be print, 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 borrow, borrow, borrow. I wanted to put these, just the topics on the table. There's not some big answer. There's not some completion or closure on this topic. But I wanted to throw them on the table because going all the way back to something like Think Little, you know, in that Wendell Berry is talking about, yes, we can have protest movements. Yes, we can go as citizens and lobby the state and do so forcefully and persuasively and intelligently. Still, the real crux of it all is on each of us as individuals and to make little small changes ourselves. and his piece too on, I think I read some of his comments that he delivered at a book festival about ducking any last words that he's not looking for and doesn't even believe in the one big solution to the big problem, but that rather it's hundreds of people, thousands of people, each working out their own solutions, none of them getting famous. That's how you work your way through things. And this is written in 2008 in October, so he mentions Obama and McCain, but it's just incredibly telling that when Travelers and Citibank merge, I believe, as the story goes, it's not even legal. And Sandy Weill, the chairman, kind of winks at the podium and says, that's okay, we'll get taken care of. And under President Clinton, Glass-Steagall is just gone. And if I can find those that footage and stuff, I'll post it in the show notes here at regular.fm/63. And if it's still out there, there's just this amazing video of President Bush at a podium bragging about, and this is, I believe, in 2002, and of course everything blows up in the housing market in 2008. If you've never read The Big Short, watch the movie version of The Big Short. Couldn't recommend it more highly. Michael Lewis is great, and the film is great. Michael Lewis had, I believe, no involvement with the film other than his book and the rights, and it came out great. At this speech, President Bush has the officials from Fannie and Freddie and banks in the room, and he's bragging about all of these proposals that there are a lot of people who still have not bought a home, and they're going to make it even easier for you to buy a home. That one of the challenges they've learned is paperwork, so they don't want you to have to read that much. One of the challenges is coming up with a down payment, so they're going to make it possible for you to go buy a very expensive home without a down payment. They're ripping out all of this stuff that was appropriate. I forget what the 4 C's or the 5 C's of credit, that you needed to have certain credit, collateral and cash and character and such in order to borrow that kind of money. And it was for your own protection. You have a whole slice of a generation of people in the early 2000s that are brought into these financial instruments that don't make any sense. And it all hits the wall. They lose their homes. They lose their credit rating. They suffer the consequences. And the banks are bailed out. Obviously, something crazy is playing out in the student loan market right now as well. Inflation and college costs continues to rise. The percentage of administrative staff to teaching staff continues to rise. The politicians and the banks have whipped up this way to finance it all with individual borrowing. And it's insane what's going on. It's going to trap a huge slice of a whole generation. And it's interesting because if, like Hernando de Soto, if you go back and listen to the episodes and reading from, talking about Mystery of Capital, if you're going to grant good intentions to these individuals and not see them as sinister, you know, conspiratorial thieves sitting in, you know, quiet rooms hatching these nefarious plans, but that it is, quote, good intentions that have just gone off the rails, well, it's ironic, isn't it? It's punishing. It's terrible. It's insult to injury that arguably it's the people, the populations who for generations had been excluded by rule, by the banks and the law from real estate in different parts of town, from access to credit, have been literally, you know, denied and excluded. Well, when these same banks and politicians decide what they're going to do is help and fix them out, they do it merely by loaning them money. And it didn't work. This talk by President Bush is quite haunting because it didn't even take a decade and the whole thing completely hit the wall. there's also in this period, there's just this amazing supercut of, I think they're all the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke. I don't think they have Geithner or Paulson. I think it's all Bernanke in a series of comments saying, no, there's nothing wrong in the housing market. Oh, there's a little something wrong in the housing market, but it's contained and it's only here. Oh, it's only regional. And over and over and over. And I think it just flashes the dates in which he's saying these things. He was definitely wrong. And the things that coming out of his mouth were completely wrong, proven very quickly to be the opposite of what was actually happening. It does make you wrestle with, was he just simply mistaken? Or was he lying through his teeth? Or, you know, a little bit of both. But in any case, in our system, this individual at this private corporation, government thing, has all of this power. These, quote, decision-making authorities in the language of the article read today. It's all just incredibly fascinating stuff. I think it's important for all of us to wrestle with because we've been talking a lot. I've been talking a lot lately about like things like habits and productivity and learning, and because these are sort of the fundamentals of life and being an entrepreneur and being a parent. But the whole point is to be able to go out and make some hay. And then what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to save and invest and participate in this economy and ensure that our neighbors can as well? And it's just not a good feeling if we're all being hoodwinked and robbed. And if these kinds of distortions and shenanigans go on long enough, well, then more and more people start to listen to a whole host of really terrible ideas because they just begin to see the entire thing as wholly and completely rigged and corrupt and unworthy of any respect and having lost any authority at all. That's another fundamental argument of Hernando de Soto in Mystery of Capital, and I think he's got a documentary series called Capitalism at the Crossroads. He's making a global argument that there are these places where people are excluded from the system, and what people want, again, this just comes through Julian Simon, Wendell Berry, Hernando de Soto, John Taylor Gatto. What people want is to create, see their families develop, see their communities develop, feel themselves develop, engage in trade, participate in the economy. And when they're locked out, when they're screwed, when they're lulled along into these traps, and when the traps engage, they're the only ones caught. And the people who laid the trap just dance on to whatever's next. It's a big dang problem. I like it. They're just little touches in this article, but Siobhan talking about how it's an intellectual and a cultural problem. Talking about how it's easy to just get down and have a sense of doom because the idea that the fundamentals might actually change in a way that's constructive is hard to actually imagine getting there. But maybe now with this current presidential administration, with this current media climate, which is, they have gone, in my opinion at least, completely off the rails. I need never be provided any information by these organs. I just absolutely distrust anything that I'm hearing that has their bug on the screen. Maybe with this virus, it will provide a jolt, wake people up, destabilize certain equilibriums. Now, we may not go in a productive direction. We may go in a wildly unproductive direction. It's going to be a lot of all of it, it seems. Best of times, worst of times kind of situation. And so we have to be very careful and bring it all back to you, me, each individual, our households, our neighborhoods, and go back to Big Nahogan. Got to get a grip. Think first of the grip, and then and only then the stance. We're a long way from swinging a golf club here. A long way. But what's amazing is how there seems to be such a disconnect between these political, media, and, I suppose, banking and financial market institutions from what's necessary in the basic building blocks of life, literally the building blocks of our neighborhoods. It's a bit of a conundrum. So I just wanted to get these ideas into the mix. We're already in the 60s here on these dispatches. And the only real economic stuff I've even touched on from economists, I guess, is Eleanor Ostrom, a little bit of Coase, a little bit of DeSoto, a little bit of Julian Simon. And it feels good to be saying, you know, Higgs and Mises and Hayek. So we'll see where that takes us next. And another element I like too is it starts. I guess Peter Zeihan with geopolitics and that kind of thing does put macro, bigger scale considerations on the table. And I've talked his stuff a couple of times. So in any event, this is cool. Thanks for listening. I guess to continue a recent trend, I did get up at 4:50 this morning. I didn't record early in the morning, but I did have a great morning, and I'm really liking getting up early, really early, and may start dialing it even slightly earlier. And sorry I didn't get this one posted by 7, but I hope to the rest of the week. Y'all be good. Thanks.